This is the Saturday Night Live's 20th Day of Sobriety, the 7:45 meeting. Our speaker this evening will be Clara S. From Los Angeles. It's held at El Paseo Shopping Center, well, the Saturday Night Live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is in the El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120 in San Jose, California, and this tape was made on May 28th, 1993. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes, and please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober tonight and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Diane and Terry and the group for inviting me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege and honor to be asked to do that. I'm celebrating life, and I am happy to be here and see some friends I've had before and to make new friends. And I saw the hands of the newcomers, and I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you'll keep coming back with an open mind and join us. And we listen to the similarities and not the differences. And let us love you until you can learn to love yourselves. And I'm grateful when I sat in my first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that was the message I heard from the old-timers who were there to greet us. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just celebrated a birthday last month by the grace of God and one day at a time from my first meeting for 19 years. And by the time I sat in that first meeting, I am here to tell you that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. And it had stripped me of all moral values, and I couldn't even die. By that time, I was a Wynette. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, chapter 3, more about alcoholism, it explains the insane things that we continue to do to keep from doing step 1 and 2. And in that chapter, it says we switch to natural wines. I had switched to Ripple. Not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't think grapes have ever been near that stuff. I think they just put some chemicals in a bottle, shook it up real hard, and put it on the shelves, and by that time I was living in the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles doing a dance of death, because I was very often drinking that Ripple right out of the, when it was still in the paper bag. Living in that ghetto with two young children, an 8-year-old daughter and a 9.5-year-old son, it was right near the area where the riot was last year. And I'm a real alcoholic, the kind described in the big book on page 21. I had drank for 27 years on a daily basis and had drank alcoholically from the first drink. And I hadn't, for many years, I was in control, I thought, because I didn't throw up and I didn't pass out and I wasn't doing those things that people who are out of control in their alcoholism did. As I would watch them around those bars, I started to drink in the East, in Boston, Massachusetts. But I was completely out of control by that time. And I would come to very often, spread eagle in the front yard, face buried in the grass, looking like the grass was growing up my nose, and come to it in that awful hour of the morning. I don't know if any of you have ever come to it. 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and all I could hear was my heart beating in my ears. It sounded like a rapid drum. And that silence, as if the world had come to a standstill, and I could just hear nothing but quiet. And if it was in the summer or the spring, I could hear night birds calling to each other. And in the ghetto, dogs travel in packs. Because they don't have owners, they just have litters. They drop them in the alleys and under vacant houses and laying out there in that grass. And they had metal trash cans out on the sidewalk, and I could hear seven or eight of those dogs charge the can and knock the can over into the streets, and you hear the lid rolling. And it would slow down, and then it would just wobble down until that sound was, you know, just quiet again. I make a few deals with God. Not that I believed in God, but it was deal time. I'd come from the streets. I know all about street life, and I know you make deals. God, if you just get me out of that this time, sometimes I get desperate. Tell God, if you just get me off the ground, today I'll go to PTA meetings. I'm 19 years and a month and so sober, and I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. Struggle up off the ground, stand in the middle of the yard, try to get the dew off my shoulder, straighten up my red wig. As long as you're out there, you might as well look good. Look around, see who's looking. I assure you, nobody in South Central Los Angeles was concerned about how I was looking drunk in the front yard. Lady across the street took it upon herself to kind of monitor the neighborhood. At any hour, I always knew she was there. I just felt her presence. And I look across the street and I see her little curtains moving back and forth. And after I got my cool look in the middle of the yard, give her the finger. Stumble up the steps. Try to walk straight. God forbid she should think I'm drunk. Get through the door, lean on the door, and God, was I sick. Physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I would feel it coming, and I'd have to charge down the hall. I'd charge down that hall, get to that dirty bathroom, get on my knees, do a few chin-ups on the rim of the toilet. And while my chin is sliding around, trying to find a comfortable place to rest. Reminds me of this story. I was in this church, and the minister said to the congregation, "Does anybody in here know where God is?" This little 9-year-old boy raised his finger and said, "I know, preacher." And he said, "Well, how do you know?" He said, "Well, every night my daddy comes home drunk. Comes up the steps, goes to the living room, goes down the hall, goes into the bathroom, gets on his knees in front of the toilet bowl. And I can hear him in there saying, oh, God." So there I am, making a few more deals with God. Pass out again at the base of the toilet in a fetal position. And come out of the blackout one more time. And I don't know about you, but I can remember how the room was always spinning. And I try to slow down the spin. So I try to focus on something that would slow it down a little bit. The two words that always greeted me was American Standard. Get up. The wonderful Dr. Silkworth, who gave the Fellowship of Alcoholics the first step, that says we are powerless over alcohol. And the second half of the first step that says our lives are unmanageable. And then Dr. Silkworth studies, he talks about the phenomenon of craving of the alcoholic. And I would have to get up one more time and start to get dressed to make the run. And I would have to break my promise. And I promised myself yesterday I wasn't going to do that today. And see, the body would start to roll like a motor. Here I was living in the ghetto living off food stamps and welfare, and I believe I had drawn the drapes and was doomed to die of this disease. And I was 65 pounds overweight, pull on those tight jeans, put on my bad leather jacket, straighten up that wig, put on the starfire earrings that would hang to my shoulders. And by that time, my mode of transportation was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. Slide into my slippers, and I was paranoid, and I was really well into the second step. And in the ghetto, it's not about community, and people are not about cutting the grass and painting the houses and being a part of anything. And that little place I lived in probably hadn't been painted for years. Some of the paint was still stuck to the wood, but the rest of it had peeled off. In the dampness of the night, the wood would get damp, and when the sun would start to come up and warm the wood, it would sound like somebody was scratching outside. And God, I was so paranoid, and I was already into hallucinations. But the thing that would break my heart is when I was going to have to pass the room where two children slept. And I would tiptoe because I didn't want to wake the kids up, because I didn't want to break my promise to them that Mama wasn't going to have to go down there again today. And then the guilt would start. But you see, I'm an alcoholic, and when I need a drink, I need a drink, and I'm willing to pay any price for that. And I could, above all those terrible sounds that were outside, I could hear them sleeping, and I just tiptoe past the door, open the door quietly, sneak down the steps feeling like a thief in the night. Cross the street and past three houses, stand in front of the liquor store door, wait for the man to come. Staring at the world out of my dark glasses and feeling what I always felt when I stared out of those glasses in those early mornings when it was still dark out. And I always felt, you know, that the world was a hostile place to live in, and I had never known how to live in the world comfortably. Wondering what happened to all those fair-weather friends. I'm talking about the ones I had wined and dined, had bought all the love that I could afford. Bill Wilson, who's a co-founder of our program that I believe is divinely inspired. And in Bill's chapter, he talks about his fair-weather friends, and I wonder what happened to him. Not one of them ever showed up in the front of the liquor store door on those mornings when I was having the throwaways, you know, and the flashing in my head, and said to me, "Claire, how are you this morning, and what are you going to do about your life today? And when are we going to lunch?" See, those days were all over, and my phone wasn't ringing. Finally, the guy would come, and I would trail, and he'd get these big bunch of keys, and he'd stand there, and I was always feeling like I was going to self-destruct, and he's going to pick out the right key. And then he'd open the door, and I'd trail in there behind him and stand at that counter, feeling that feeling of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And he put the change away, and I'm standing there trying to be cute. Well, I hadn't been cute for a long time. I mean, you don't even smell cute when you've lost the will to care. And when ripple is coming out of the pores of your skin, it doesn't exactly smell like Chanel No. 5. And I'm standing there waiting for the guy, and he looks like something about those guys in the ghetto. I mean, they have kind of a bored look early in the morning. Turn your head sideways, ask your dumb question, like, "Hey, you know, like, what are you going to have this morning?" "Now, look, man, I didn't get out of bed this early to come down here for milk. Now, let's not play any games this morning," because I was used to playing the games of life, because that's what I had spent my life, 27 years of daily drinking, playing the games of life, simply because I didn't know how to live it. "Your biggest choice is whether you should get the red ripple or the white ripple." And I would make my choice, and he would hand it to me, and I'd shove my hands in my pocket and pull out 59 cents. Very often I had stolen it from my children. I'm one of those mothers that had reached that demoralized behavior. And the grandparents would give my kids money for their bank, and their aunts and uncles would give them money for their bank, and I'd come with the hammer. I come with the hammer, man, tear up the bank, and promise myself I'm going to give it back to him. And throw my 59 cent up there on the counter. I'm into service, and I come to believe, of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have come to believe that service is a spiritual process to the process of being a spiritual person in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I would throw that money up on that counter and shove that 59 cent under his nose, I was in a prison facility not long ago, sharing, and I was talking about the 59 cent, and this young man up in the back of the room yelled out, "It's gone up to $1.18. And I said, well, I'm glad I quit while I was ahead, you know. He'd hand me my wine, and I would prance out of there telling this guy about have a good day. I didn't care what kind of day he had. I just wanted to get out of his sight, get past the little plate glass window, lean on the building. My days of fine drinking had long been over. And I didn't have to worry about bottle openers and the proper cocktail napkins and stirrers and drinking out of crystal glasses and thinking about that mood music. And the faces of smiling, handsome men. How many times that I had sat in the jazz clubs of Boston, New York, and Harlem and looked into the faces of smiling, handsome men only to learn that sometimes smiling faces tell lies. Lean on that building, unscrew that top off that wine, take a hit off of it, and worked. Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And it would always work for a fleeting second. It would just get me quieted down enough that I wasn't rolling like a machine and truck on back to that house and sit in that overstuffed chair with a tear cloth robe on. Watch the dawn come up. Feeling like the man who said I had a dream last night. The life was passing me by, and I was no longer in the dreams of life. Hear those kids come out of that darkened room. Go into that kitchen, make their breakfast, make their lunch. And I talk about tomorrow. Gonna get out of the chair tomorrow. Sit there and cry silent tears about those broken dreams and those unresolved relationships. And when they pass me by and with their little heads down, and she was 8 years old, he was 9 and a half, and they never said goodbye. And they go on down those steps, and I see their heads go past the window. We talk about we tell our stories in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'd sit there in that chair and drink that wine. Sometimes I would try to doctor it up and make a cocktail out of it. And then sometimes in L.A., it would be really warm, and I'd pour it in a glass and put a slice of lemon, and sometimes a slice of orange and a cherry. And take a hit off my wine and pass out. When I come to, fruit flies would be soaking in my wine. And every once in a while, one or two would fall in. So the phenomenon of craving would start the minute I opened my eyes, and I'd sit there and stare and watch them swing around on the top of my wine, and I'd reach in there and follow them and grab them. Flip them away and tell myself really loud and clear, alcohol kills all germs. And then I drink it. And I would sit there and wonder, how did I ever get from that place in my life to this place? It wasn't meant to be this way. You know, I had other plans. And I have learned that life is what happens to you while you make other plans. Because when I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, in a very nice family, considered at the time, in a very affluent black family. We had everything that the best that money could buy for the outside. And I'm the youngest of 7 children. My parents were not alcoholics, and the other 6 brothers and sisters were not alcoholics and are not alcoholics. And I'm the youngest, and I'm the alcoholic. And I believe I was born restless, irritable, and discontented, right out of the chute. And I never knew or believed that I fit in that family. I didn't even know how it got there. And I was always angry and full of rage, and I just didn't seem to know how to interact with people. I'm one of the ones that could have used a little drinky poo in the first grade. Just to get me to the second grade. I was always uncomfortable. I always had the feelings, as young as I was, without understanding what the feelings were about. We talk about our feelings in Alcoholics Anonymous because I never felt any sense of being. I was always felt inadequate and with no self-worth and low self-esteem, and yet I had it all on the outside. And all I figured is, you know, my father used to say, you know, you always look good. You look good on the, you know, you just look good. And when the messages was being passed around in that family, I don't know where I was, I missed it. My father was a full-blooded Indian who was born in Cherokee, North Carolina on a reservation. And I never liked rules, and I had to go by his rules and the rules in that Baptist church that we went to. And today I have nothing against the church. I read the chapter to the agnostic, and I have no problems with that today. But at the time, I had a lot of problems with the church. I had a lot of problems with the rules and judging. Nobody seemed to understand, you know, how I felt about trying to change the system. I grew up a loner, and when I was in high school, my father was an artist and an entrepreneur, and he had all that, you know, that a really talented man. And in high school, in my senior year at Booker T. Washington High School, my art teacher came to me one day and she said, "You know, Claire, I think you got enough talent that we might apply for an art scholarship for you." Well, I never thought anything good in life would ever happen to me, and I knew I wasn't going to get it, but, you know, she decided that's what she's going to do. And she applied for this art scholarship, and the word came back that I'd gotten it. And it was to the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And so I remember that they packed me up and got me all gussied up and put me on that segregated train, man. I was so glad to get out of Atlanta. And I understand I gave Atlanta a finger, and I said, "No." I love Atlanta today. I've in sobriety, I've been there several times, and I've learned that when I go there, I certainly don't have the feelings I had when I left there, because what has changed has been me. By the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, based on these 12 steps, and honoring the traditions of this program, I believe that these steps are spiritual in principle. And so when I was sitting on that train, going to Boston, I didn't know that I was taking me with me. You know, those same feelings went there. And I stepped off and got into Boston and walked into that school. I knew it was all a mistake. And I, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous filled with secrets. Heard a man at the podium say one night, "You know, we are as sick as our secrets." And my secret was I really didn't want to be in that school, and I just didn't fit anywhere. So, but what I really wanted to be was a performer. Now, I was another fantasy. My life was filled with fantasies. I always looked at other people and saw what they had, what I wanted. I just know how to get it. And I thought, well, I would like to be a performer. Now, I don't know how I got into that one, since I can't sing and I can't dance. But I go and hang out in the movies a lot and watch people do it on the screen, and I thought it would all rub off on me by osmosis. And I learned that nothing rubs off on you by osmosis, not even in Alcoholics Anonymous. In order to get the promises, we got to work for it. And I was a loner in Boston. And one night I was walking down the street with another student. I love jazz music. And as we were walking down the street, I hear these people were coming out of a door, and I heard this great music. And I just, on chance, I'd never seen alcohol, and when I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia was a dry state, and the neighbors and the people in that church, I'd never seen a person intoxicated. There are parts of my story in my life and as a teenager that I simply don't remember, and as the book says, more will be revealed, that I just don't remember ever knowing that alcohol existed. But we walked in, this friend and I walked into this club, and it was dark, and the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze and the lights were dim, and this lady was down at the end of the bar, and she was singing this great get-down music. My heart started pumping, and we walk up to this bar, and I sat on a stool. The bartender leaned over with a penitent smile. And he said, "Where are you going to have the drink?" And I had no idea. But I remembered in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. Leaned on that bar, looked him straight in the face, said, "We don't have a martini, honey." I said, "And make it dry." I had no idea what I was ordering. He turns around, puts these two stem glasses up there, evened it out. It looked like lemonade. I look up and down the bar. I don't know. I really don't see about sipping drinks. So I picked it up, drank it all in one go. I was a pig from the gate. But I remember the way it made me feel. And that feeling of magic. Let me tell you what that first drink did for me. It quieted the silent screaming that was always going on inside. And I also believe that first drink dimmed the light of my soul. And for those next 27 years, the light kept getting dimmer. And by the time I was in a fetal position on the dirty floor in the ghetto, the soul had died. And the soul was sick. I stepped off that bar and that glass in my hand, looked around. I right away got myself some new friends. I called them colorful. But the big book calls them law companions. And I stayed out there so long, I became one of the lower companions. And pretty soon they kicked me out of that school, and it was mutual. I was hanging in those clubs every night, and I loved it. I loved to drink. I loved the music. I just loved being out there, walking that walk, and learning what you do in the streets. And you know, I still love jazz, and there's a jazz singer, and her name is Randy Crawford, and she, a few years ago, put out a song about street life. She said, if you're young, don't get old in the streets. The cold will hit you in the back and you're nickeling down your life away. You look back one day and it was all a masquerade. Because what you have to do to survive in the streets is you have to be a role player. And I learned how to play the role. Change the color of those wigs and, you know, and crawl up on the bar stool every night, ask the question, and anybody that would listen, who do you want me to be tonight? Because I didn't know that other person. I didn't know who lived inside here. You know, it was always that feeling of void inside there. And it was, you know, it was like, it looked like every drink I took would never fill up that hole that's always felt so uncomfortable inside of me. And I met a nice young man, and he had came from a similar background, and he became my drinking buddy, and we got married. We stayed in that relationship for 24 years, and it was really one of the sickest relationships I believe that two people could ever have been in. You know, we were too frightened to leave each other, and so we just kept on doing the dance and took no responsibility for ourselves. And that little, we had a little son, and later when we moved to California, we had the other two children. And then when that little son was coming along, and I was too busy, and I took him and took him over to his grandparents to raise. There's a part in the book that describes the kind of alcoholic I was when it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. We're driven people. We are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I could have added to my list ad infinitum. But the pain would start, and I, who was never in touch with my feelings, when I would, out of guilt, would have to go visit this little boy. And in my opinion, there is nothing sadder than to look in the eyes of a child when you are constantly lying to him because you can't tell the truth. Dr. Silkworth, who was not an alcoholic, who in describing the alcoholic behavior, he said they, meaning us, he said they come to a place when they cannot differentiate the difference between the truth and the false. And when I'd go and that little boy was growing up and he'd look at me with that look of disappointment, and I would make the promises that I couldn't keep, and I would say, I'll take you to the park. You know, he said, but you said that last time. And I said, I know, babe. The next time. Pat him on the head and get out of that house, because his eyes would drive me out, and I would have to get in that car and go back down and sit on the nearest bar stool in the nearest jazz club with the rest of the geniuses of Boston. And we would resolve the problems of the world. And by the end of the legal drinking time, we were all legends in our own heads. And then we'd go on to the after hour clubs. By that time, I was a star kisser and an entourage junkie, hanging out with a lot of the late great stars of that jazz era. A lot of them have gone on and passed on from this disease. And when my ex-husband traveled in the family business, I would start to look for Mr. Wonderful. I have an addictive personality. I wanted anything was never enough for me. You know, I sometimes believe that when I came out of the shooting, the doctor smacked me on the tush, I probably hollered, "More," you know. So when he was traveling, I'm hanging out in the jazz clubs, the after-hour places, and one morning I'm sitting on a stool next to the late great legend and who had become my friend, if any of you like jazz, Billie Holiday. And Billie and I were drinking together. And if you hang in those clubs long enough, Mr. Wonderful shows up. In New York and Harlem, I was always looking for Mr. Wonderful. But there I'm sitting in Boston, and there he stood at the end of the bar. Black hat turned down all the way around. Had a top coat over his shoulders. He was so cool he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. He leaned in my face with one eye closed. Reached in his pocket, pulled out this wad of money, peeled off 10 $100 bills, spread it on the bar like a deck of cards, and whispered to me, "Spend it." All right. Then I knew that God had answered my prayer. Well, I was already into step two, and Mr. Wonderful turned out to be the head of the mafia of the New England family. And suddenly I've got a limousine to ride in at night with bodyguards, Dick and Jerry. All the hardware on the floor, the hat on the holsters and the guns, and I was so insane. You know, I just knew that every woman in Boston envied me. Riding around with the mob. We'd pull up in front of those clubs and he'd step out and I'd step out and Dick and Jerry would taste the place they'd come back to the car and say to us, "It's okay, boss," and then we all go in and the night would begin. And on and on and on. It seems to me that the God that I've come to believe in, having come to this program, as I said, a roaring agnostic, would try to get my attention sometimes in my moments of madness. And I believe that I took different roads, but I would always take the road that was self-destructive. There was something about the inside of me that didn't want to be here, didn't know why I was here. The more I drank, I couldn't fill it up, and I was lonely in the crowd. I was in a place with all the laughter, and the clinking of the ice and the cigarette smoke and the whole thing, and I was lonely. And one morning I was being driven home in that limousine, and it was on a Sunday morning, but I looked out of the rear window, and on the corner stood these young families with their little children all dressed up. Across the street was a church, and I looked over at the church, and it was like a voice. You know, we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous as a moment of clarity. And it was like a voice said to me, "Clara, something is wrong with your life." And I agreed. The problem was Boston. If I just got out of Boston, stopped hanging around with the pimps and the hookers and the madams who were all my friends, and stopped living this low life, my family had looked at me and they just could not understand my lifestyle. I know the difference today between a lifestyle and life. Because today, by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in this fellowship, a loving God in my life today, even though that void has been filled, and the light is beginning to grow, and it is growing. And I know that I just felt that when I looked out that window, that what I need to do was get out of Boston. We made a decision, moved to California, moved into the Los Angeles, Santa Monica area. Had those other two children, went into a small maintenance business, office building maintenance business, and I began to drink it away. I had long since crossed that line, whatever that line is, where I was out of control with my drinking, and I was getting into a lot of violent behavior, and the violent behavior was for me. That husband had to leave. The families had moved out from the East Coast to the West Coast to continue taking care of those children because they loved them. And those children never went without the material things. And I am grateful to God that I never physically abused them and I never verbally abused them, but I abused them emotionally. And it took me in my first 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous with the loving care of my sponsor and going to Al-Anon to learn to forgive myself because I just, you know, emotionally damaged them. So I never thought I'd stand in the meeting and thank God that I was beginning to lose it all. I stood outside that house, that older son had grown up. He was like a stranger to me. I'd never really known who he was. I wasn't there to raise him and nurture him and love him because I didn't know what the word love meant. For me, it was a four-letter word, and you bought it. And he was 18 years old by this time. The marshal's putting the lock on the door because the bankers repossessed the house. The Internal Revenue had taken all our assets, and he was gone. And I'm standing outside the house with the two younger children and the 18-year-old son. He's looking at me, but the look had changed. It wasn't the look of a disappointed little boy, but an 18-year-old young man who had tears in his eyes. But the tears didn't run. I just guess it wasn't macho for an 18-year-old young man to cry over a drunken mother who was beginning to wake up with strangers for the price of a drink. And I was on my way to the ghetto. Those sisters in that family who loved me so much looked at me as families look at you. And I went to one of those sisters, tried to borrow the money to stay at the house, and she said no. I believe today that God is working in their lives to get to mine because they finally said no. We are not going to bail you out of trouble anymore. We're not going to sign any more checks. And my attitude was in screw you too because you don't understand. That older sister of mine who was a nurse looked at me and they had been high achievers and had been successful and active in that church and in the community who seemed to know how to live in the world comfortably. And she looked at me and she said, I tell you, we love you. And it pains us to watch you live the way you live and it pains us to watch you die. She said, but we're going to pray for you because we love you. And I've come to believe in the power of prayer because they went out of my life and that son turned and walked away, and I picked up the bag and took the two kids and went on down into the ghetto, started and ended up in hospitals, not for the treatment of alcoholism, but for being battered in the streets while under the influence of alcohol. Come out of those black houses in strange places with strange people, wondering how I got there, you know. Going into those hospitals, the interns patching me up and stitching me up and sitting me back out in the world where I didn't know how to live. And there I was in County Jail Hospital with nervous interns and watching those kids and the shame on their face, and we'd go to the market and I'd have to pull out the food stamps. Hey, you know about that ego, that person that rode in limousines, who gambled and played the game all that time, and they'd hang their heads. And one night, I was out there in the streets one more time, and came that Sunday morning. I was in a little area called Inglewood, California, a little area outside of L.A., and came to another Sunday morning, God trying to get my attention, but by this time, I am truly doing a dance of death. The music had stopped, and I was trying to recapture the magic of the first martini. One drink for me was too many, and a million never would have been enough to recapture the magic. Laying there, and you know, the paramedics, people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. How many times did I sit in an overstuffed chair contemplating suicide, only to learn that committing suicide is a final solution to temporary problems? The paramedics patched me up, two nuns leaning on me, police at the foot of the bed. The older nun wasn't thrilled with me at all because I was giving her a lot of lip, and I always gave people lip, to keep them away from me. And she turned and stormed out of the room. The young nun stood there, and I had come to believe that God speaks to us through others. She couldn't have been over 23 years old. Stood there, her eyes were as blue as the heavens. And she stood there and with that look of compassion and love for another human being that I absolutely knew nothing about. She looked down at my face. I had a brain concussion. And the dry blood had just closed up the corners of my eyes. And this young man took a cloth and was trying to get the blood out of my eyes. And my face looked like somebody had used it as a trampoline. And in and out of that blackout, I could hear my ribs being kicked out and broken one at a time. I know about the physical pain. And I have also learned that pain has no memory. And I would keep doing the same insane things over and over again, expecting a different result. And she looked down at me, and she didn't say things people always said to me, like, why don't you stop drinking? You're going to kill yourself. She looked at me, and she said, how did you ever let your life get into such a state? And boy, I heard that young nun, because I looked up at her, but I didn't say anything. And 3 days later, I guess God assigned her to dress me, because they had 2-inch wide adhesive tape around my ribs, and I was up like this, and she put that jacket on me, and you should have seen her trying to get that red wig. She didn't know where the front and the back. She was trying to figure it out, and I remember she escorted me to the front door of that hospital, and she said to me, "1974." And I don't know what was different that morning than all those other mornings. When I would come out of those blackouts and have to make the run, I believe for me it was a divine intervention, that a power greater than myself kissed me gently and told me to get off the floor, that I never ever had to live like an animal again. I was living like an animal. I had lost all control, all body control. And when Bill Wilson talked about his spiritual experience, and having called Dr. Silkworth and explaining to him what he had felt, that feeling of a clear wind that was blowing through and through. And Dr. Silkworth said, well, I don't know what's happened to you, but hang on to it. It's better than what you had before. And Bill Wilson said that God come to most men gradually, but his impact upon him had been sudden and profound. And I stood up in a dirty room. It was still dark. And I felt what I believe was the presence of a divine spirit. And I felt different. I picked up the phone and called a friend, my last friend, who was not an alcoholic. And I finally copped that I was going to die if I didn't stop drinking. I had sworn I would never tell anybody that. That was my secret. And she said, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know what they do, but people stay sober. And you call them, and I called that morning, and the man answered the central office. He said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you? And I said, man, my name is Claire, and I can't stop drinking. And that one little moment of truth, and that's what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous about those 12 steps. It is the truth in those steps that will set you free. I immediately felt relieved that I had told somebody that I was going to die. And I had prayed that morning. That's something I had sworn I would never do when I was sitting on that train and left Atlanta, that I would never have to go to church again, and I would never pray. And he said, you don't drink an Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, don't drink today. It seems too simple. You know, I have learned that Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for complicated people. And I would complicate anything in a flash. But I believed him, and what I heard from that stranger on that phone that morning was hope. And newcomers, that's what we're about. We're about hope. There's hope in these rooms, that you can get better, and that there is a path, and there is a spiritual path, and there's a better way to live. And the book says that's what it's designed. It's a new way to live. Never did I know when I was sitting in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that my life was going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of living. And he told me where to go, and he said, we have meetings, and I called my brother and told him I think that I found a place for me, and it was called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed a car to get to my first meeting.
And he came over, and I can still hear him running up the stairs. And he came through the door, and he embraced me, and he kissed me, and he said, "I hope this is going to work for you, because we hate to see you living the way you live." And he said, "Keep the car as long as you want to use it." And I started to get dressed that morning for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope I never go through that experience again. I didn't know the language. I learned, as Brian said, it is the language of the heart. And I started to, you know, I wanted to look good. I didn't know what you guys were about. And so around 10 o'clock, and now I just wasn't going to make the run. I started to shake a little bit, and I opened the closet door, and went to where I had a red velvet dressing, and it had wine stains on it. So I got the dress out and cleaned up the stains, and around 12 o'clock, I got that red wig out. Let me tell you a little bit about the wig. I've been hiding on that wig for about 5 years, and if that wig alone could have talked, it would have blackmailed me. And so I get the wig out, put some bangs, and kind of made a little bouffant, you know, and sprayed it up and put it on the head form. And she was looking pretty good. Around 2 o'clock, I couldn't stand the pain. I guess I was withdrawing, you know, for the first time. I was going a few hours without a drink for the first time in 27 years. So I decided to get out of the house. My arms were swollen, and I was going around in a circle like a caged animal. So I went over to Woolworth. Well, it used to be there. They burned it down now, but it used to be over there, and I went over there, and I stole some eyelashes from the first meeting. Now, they come quite long, and I didn't know you're supposed to trim them down the side. It was 8 o'clock meeting, at 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, got my red dress on, got my wig on, and I got these lashes in one hand, and they come with a little tube of glue. And I get the glue along the edge of the lash, and I'm standing in front of the mirror, and I'm bouncing off the wall, you know. And I'm shaking, and I'm waiting for an opportune moment. And I slam the lash in. And one end is up here, and one end is down there. And I lean in the mirror, I say, "You are looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked up to the door, and my friend Scotty, who's got about 28 years, was the greeter. And he put his hand out, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He says, "Come on in and get yourself a cup of coffee." We had real cups in those days, and I went over to the table, and I was looking around. Everybody was chattering and kissing each other, and I went over there, and I filled it too full, and then I put it down because I didn't want you seeing me shaking the way I was shaking. I sat in the seat, and I'm going to tell you, I believed that God had etched my name on the chair, and I had paid the price. And sitting there in that chair looking around that room, and I felt safe for the first time in my whole life. There was some feeling of comfort, and I didn't have to run anymore. I had come to the end of the road, and Alcoholics Anonymous had to be the last house on the block. I tried all those things, and nothing had worked. And they got up and they started to meet, and they asked for the hands of a newcomer, and I didn't know I was a newcomer. I had never had a friend out of all those years of all that drinking and playing the game of life in the streets. Not one of those friends that I used to hang out with made it. They all died of this disease. I'm the only one out of the crowd. I believe that God had a purpose for me in my life when I never had a purpose in my life. And when I was sitting there listening, and the lady behind me touched me on my shoulder, and she said, "You're a newcomer, honey." She said, "Raise your hand." And I raised my hand, and they said they talked about coming at 90 meetings in 90 days, and at the coffee break she gave me a phone number, and she said, "You go home and call me, and I'll tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous." And she became my sponsor that night. She's still my sponsor tonight. We have walked this journey together. She's my friend, my confidant, and she is my spiritual teacher. And we got into the steps, and I love you all, but I salute the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was too sick to go to meetings, and they drive over there from Brentwood and those fancy areas and take me to meetings, and I was beginning to participate in the lives of my children, and she had started me off to go to a few Al-Anon meetings, and I was still on food stamps or welfare because I had no skills. I was too physically ill to work. But I went to a lot of meetings, and that's what they said would work. You go to a lot of meetings, you get the book, and you study that book, and you get a sponsor, and you get into service, and you're guaranteed the promises. And you have never lied to me. Because that's exactly what has happened in my life. I live in the promises today. And so when I was about 6 months older, she said to me, "You got to get a job." I wasn't really too thrilled with the news. She said, "You're self-supporting through our own contributions." She said, "You go get a job." And I protested, but I went and got a job. I was always afraid not to do what my sponsor said to do because it was a time to come in my life where I better take some direction. Because the directions I had set out for myself, had been a total failure. And as I got a job as a waitress, I want to tell you, I was a terrible waitress. I spilled a lot of coffee on people. I had a bad attitude. But that job was the first place I ever learned to have some feeling of self-worth. I learned how to show up on time and give those people a full day's work for a full day's pay. And there's something that was different about that than riding in limousines and spending thousands of dollars gambling every night. But there were mornings when I didn't want to go, and I would call Carol, and I'd say, "Hey, I don't want to do this." Yeah, I'd take 3 buses to get there. And she would say, "Well, honey, just get on the bus and go on over there and don't drink today," and she'd hang up. And when I was about 2 years sober, I'd bring these greetings to my home group, the Robertson Originals, and I decided I wanted to go back into the maintenance business I had drank away. And the guys in my group helped me get these cards made, and I started on my day off from my waitress job to go into Beverly Hills, and I'd pass out my little house cleaning cards. And finally, a lady hired me. And boy, did I clean her house. I mean, I was at perfect perfection. She just loved my work. And she started telling her friend. And pretty soon I had enough customers that I quit my waitress job. And my brother, that same brother who had loaned me his car, co-signed for me to get my first little AA car. And I hired a guy to come help me because I had so much work. And that young man still works for me. And I have my company is rather large today. He's the supervisor of my company, and when I go away trying to be the messenger, I'm only the messenger. The message is in the first 164 pages of Alcoholics, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He runs the business, and so I got on with my life, and I got into those steps, and I did that 4 step, and I put my children's name on the top of the list, and I made my amends to the best of my ability and to the family, and thank God for the 8th and 9th steps. And things started getting good for me, and by the time I was between 3 and 4 years sober, I started getting well, and that's dangerous. Because, I had bought a house now, the same night, little house I still live in. I bought this big car, and I began to hear the music. And the big book says, for all of us, there will come a time, at some time, the insanity will return. And when the insanity returns, we have no mental defense against the first strength. And so I was starting to, cut down on my meetings and whine and complain. I did a lot of whining and complaining my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being in a meeting one night, and I was just telling the group what they were all doing to me out there. And when we said the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting, this guy came out of the back of the room, and he put his arms around me in a loving way, and he said, "Clara, please, come down off the cross." He said, "You need the wood." So I got on with it, and I was dancing around my living room, and I was lying to my sponsor, and those were the signals of setting it up to walk out the door. And the phone rang, and God did my attention again. It was a call from central office, and the lady said to me, "Clara," she said, "we have a 12-step call, and we'd like for you to make it." Well, I was real upset. I didn't really want to do that. And I said to her, I said, I don't think I'm qualified to make a 12-step call. And she got real annoyed with me. She said, "Don't stop it. Just take the name and the number." And I wrote down this young lady's name. Her name was Dorothy. And I got all the information. And I reluctantly, but I had always heard, you never turn down an AA request. So I called my sponsor, Carol, and I told her the situation. And I tried to tell her that I didn't think I should do that and da-da-da. And she wasn't responding to me. So finally, you know, I said to her, I don't want to do it. And she said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway. And she hung up. So I was sponsoring this little actress, a little Hollywood actress, had about 90 days. So I heard you're never going to trust that call alone. So I pick up the phone and I call her. I said, we're going on a 12-step call. And she said, well, where? I said, it's down on Skid Row. She said, oh, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. I said, you get over here. And she came over and we get in my big Eldorado, man, and we go down, we wheel it down to Skid Row, and we go into this hotel, and they give me the address. It told me wasn't any name outside. It wasn't part of the Hilton chain, I tell you that. And so we walk into this lobby, and these drunk young men, man, they got a big transistor radio, and they're dancing, they're drinking beer and wine, and they're just all over the place having a ball. There was a red arrow along the wall. It pointed to a button, and it said, ring this bell. And I pressed the little bell there, and this guy peeked out from under the slot, and he said, yeah, can I help you? And I said, do you have somebody here named Dorothy? And he said, oh, man, she's up on the third floor. Now, you take that elevator. We went up there, and she was at the end of the hall. We stepped over these drunks who passed out in the hall. We just stepped over and got down there and knocked on the door, and I heard a little voice say, come in. And we talk about the trust step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the step. And I walked into the room. It was a little room about 6 by 6, and this beautiful 21-year-old young blonde was curled up on the fetal position, drowning in her own vomit. And I had another spiritual awakening looking at her. And it was only by the grace of God. And she had lost body control, and my ego was out of the window, and I just looked down there, and I believed what I was on a journey, and had come as a messenger sent from the divine spirit, who let me see the roots of the disease and the gifts. And we picked her up, and we dressed her, and we took her down to a place. Central office told us, I called, and they told us where to take her. We're sitting in this all-night diner. And I started to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first step that says, you know, we are powerless over alcohol, and our lives are unmanageable. She can relate to that. And the insanity of the second step, that God will restore us to sanity. And the third step that says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to care of God. And she stood up and rocked back and forth. She was still quite drunk and with feeding this coffee. She said, don't you talk to me about God. And I think I had some unresolved anger. Because I stood up, reached across the table, and grabbed her by that little pink sweater, and pulled her forward. Now I was going to punch her out. The stuff says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the step, we carry the message. We didn't say anything about beating them up if they don't want it. I'm glad, you know, because of my sponsor, you know, had gotten me into the 8th and 9th step with the family. And I love the part in the big book, The Family After, because my three children are grown up today. And when I was 5 years sober, I got to see that daughter of mine go into the ice capades as the first black professional ice skater. When I was 7 years sober, that 9.5-year-old son who went to the ghetto with me took 150 sleeping pills and tried to kill himself. And there's nothing, you know, when we say we don't drink no matter what. And today he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That older son of mine, the one that he grew up without me being in his life, he's had some success in the television world, and he's had a disastrous marriage, and it was painful for him, and we've all become friends. You know, we have grown, and we are walking this road. And the longer I'm sober, the narrower the road becomes, but the wider the vision. And when we embrace each other now, and that son's marriage failed, and he has a little son, and his name is Aaron, and God's given me a second chance. Because when I promised Aaron, he's 6.5 now, and when I promised Aaron we're going to the park, man, we go to the park. Mostly we go to Toys R Us. My daughter married successfully to a nice young man. You know, they're yuppies. They live up in Santa Clarita, California. And they are very normal. They planned it all. They planned what they wanted, and they got the lot and built the house and built the pool, and then they decided to, they should start a family. I never heard of such a thing. Planning a baby. And that Saturday morning they called me over and asked me would I be in that room with the birth of that child, with his little daughter. Her name is Nicole, and she's 2 and a half. And I walked into that room, and my daughter is a beautiful young woman, and my son-in-law, they had something about the Le Mans system. And I walked into the room, and he's playing tape. And seagulls are chirping. And I look at my daughter, and the tears are running down her face, and I am wiping her brow with a lotion, and we cried together. And they were not silent tears. They were tears of joy and the blessing is a direct result of a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I made amends to those sisters, and Wednesday I was almost afraid I wasn't going to get up here to share with you today, because that older sister, the nurse, is now 88 years old. And on Wednesday I was called to the hospital because she lives in a complex of the senior citizens that's run by her church. And they found her unconscious, and we all rushed to the hospital. There are 3 of us left now. And the other sister and I, we got over there, and they couldn't wake her up. And she's in Cedar Sinai in Los Angeles, and suddenly she woke up, you know, Thursday morning. And I walked into the room, and another blessing by God's grace. That other sister passed away 2 years. I've had a lot of grief in my life, and in the last 2 years, and there's been a loss, and I never knew how to deal with grief or loss. And I believe that God has worked in my life from a list. And has never given me more than I could stand at one thing at a time. And I guess on the list now is grief and how to deal with loss. Walked into that hospital a couple of years ago, and the whole family was there, and she was 81 years old, and she's lying there in that hospital, who had had it all. Happy life, and I held her left hand with my strong right hand, and she looked at all of our faces, and she said, I am the one who wants to pray. I want to thank God for having been in this family all these years. I've had the best at life offers. She said, but I'm tired, and it's time to go. And I looked at her face, and I squeezed her hand, and I knew that I had been forgiven. I'd stolen from her. I had abused her. Her love for me all those years. And I had been interacting with them in an ongoing way because of the 8th and 9th step. And I had made my peace. And a few hours later, she was gone. It's like the wonderful Alabama Carruthers, who passed away a couple of years, a grand lady of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the example who would have had 30 years two years ago, and they're I'm just moving them all around me. And a young man that I 12 years ago is dying of AIDS, and I've lost a friend of mine that came in right after I did, and who died of AIDS. And I remember going down to one of the booth cities and sharing with her and looking across the table, and I said, how do you feel about death? She said, I have come to understand that death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is dying inside while you're still alive. And I was at peace. And when I walked out of that hospital, my son, that older son, has been diagnosed with a terminal disease. He was a heavy smoker. He's 44 years old, and the prognosis is not good. But I'm there for him today. And I go up, he lives up in this part of California, on the top of a mountain. And we sit together and we hold hands and we talk about a loving God. And there's no fear about death. Acceptance. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And I've learned that from you. It's words like this that you render me sober and you render me sane. And I'm eternally grateful. Thank you.